Morning, everyone. So, by way of introduction, could we just read Nehemiah 8 verse 2? I couldn't think of anything else clever to say. Nehemiah 8 verse 2. Ezra, Nehemiah. And so this, of course, is the Feast of Trumpets, and it just gives us a starting point for our discussion. In verse 2, it says, just to prove to you, but just to remind you that this is a Feast of Trumpets here. So Ezra, the priest, brought the law before the assembly of men and women, and all who could hear with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. So everyone's there with the families, first day of the seventh month. And so let's skip down now to verse 9. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, Ezra the priest and the scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Don't mourn nor weep. For all the people wept when they heard the words of the law." And so today is a special day, and it's not a day for mourning and weeping. So it's actually not my job to shove it in your face and say, sort yourself out and all that sort of thing to upset you. That's not the day for that. So I shouldn't do that. So what should I do? Well, we should read on. He said, "Go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, send portions to those to whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy to the Lord. Don't sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." So I should stop talking and we should just have lunch. Yeah. So then the Levites quietened the people and said, "Be still, the day is holy." And so all the people then went and their way, ate and drank, they sent portions and rejoiced greatly because they understood the words that were declared to them. So our job today is, it should be a celebration, but it says here that they understood the words. So it should be a celebration with understanding. So we should try and think about what it's all about. I mean, that's nothing new for you, but this is what this says to me, that whatever it is this day, it should be a celebration. This sort of narrows what we should be thinking about and talk about, but it should be done with understanding. So for the next little while, let's read about the day, refresh our memory, try and rederive it, so to speak, go back and just make sure that we understand it right. So we'll do that for a little bit. And then I'd like just to read some scriptures that talk about two aspects of the day. So the first little bit will be a bit of revision, the second bit will be revision too. But that'll took it two aspects, and maybe I'll try and find a couple of things that might be, might be a little bit useful to you, I hope. So we've got to start at Leviticus, right, where it says the day and gives all the details about how to keep the day. All none of them. Leviticus 23:24. Wow, okay, there's some, but there's hardly anything, is there? When you go there and you read what the day's about in Leviticus, it says hardly anything. It says, "Speak to the children of Israel, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath rest, memorial of blowing of trumpets." A holy convocation. So we've read it. A lot of you have read it heaps and heaps of times. It says very little, but it is to do with the blowing of trumpets. And when you look at the word, as I'm sure you've done, it's really about the verb, about the making of the noise. It's about the racket that they make. So it's a day of making a loud noise. And we're meant to keep this day with understanding, it says. So the onus is kind of on us to work out what is this blowing of trumpets all about. So it would be nice just to read on the next passage, because it says, "I want you to have a memorial, I want you to remember stuff, I want you to think about stuff, I want you to blow trumpets." And then I would have thought, I would have hoped that then I read on and explains to me what I'm remembering and what the trumpets are celebrating and or what they're all about. But it doesn't say that. So it's kind of presenting us with a challenge straight away, I think. It's a challenge of what I want you to think about this. I want you to blow the trumpets. Now you go work it out. Okay, so there's some other things. So, of course, we have to go to Numbers 10, where it talks about trumpets, to try and piece together what it is we are meant to be thinking about. Now, I know that we know that we have the answer, or we think we have the answer, but just bear with me as we try and rebuild it from scratch, just to make sure it hangs together. So in Numbers 10, it talks about trumpets in general for Israel. So let's just read this and see if we can gather. Well, it's kind of a mystery, isn't it? Gather any clues to what this is all meant to be about. Bear in mind, this section of the Bible is not about the Feast of Trumpets. It's about a general thing, and we're going to try and look into it to see if there's anything we can gain. So then the Lord spoke to Moses. He said, make 2 silver trumpets for yourself. You shall make them of hammered work, so a bit of metallurgy, hammering out silver. Make them of hammered work, and you shall use them. And so now we get the start of some of the purposes for trumpets. It doesn't say it's the Feast of Trumpets, just in general. So the first thing is calling the congregation together. So the first job of these silver trumpets was to gather everyone together. So those kids who are riding, that's point one, to gather everyone together. And the second one, it says, for directing movement of the camps. So first thing, loud noise, get everyone together. Second thing, okay, we've got to move on. And they didn't have a loudspeaker system, they didn't have two-way radio, so how were you going to communicate? You could say, you tell him, it could take ages. So, loud noise, big, loud volume. They didn't have lots of things when I was thinking about this back in olden times to make a loud noise. Okay, you think of drums, trumpets, but we've got heaps of things to make loud noise with electricity. But anyway, let's not get distracted just yet. So this is that with 2 points, gathering together and the movement. And now if we can skip down, there's another point that comes out in verse 9. It says, and when you go to war in the land against the enemy who oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets. So the third thing that they're used for is making a big racket for war. And you'll be remembered, and you will be remembered before the Lord your God, and you'll be saved from your enemies. So it's almost like you make a loud noise to say, hey God, listen, we're going to war. It's like, make him listen, was kind of the way it's putting it. So that was number 3. And now the number 4 one comes next. It says, also in the day of your gladness. So celebration. So that these trumpets, nice shiny silver trumpets, when you have a party. But it gives some more details. It's not just any party. It says, in the day of your gladness. So celebrating, appointed feast. So holidays in general, it seems, these trumpets are for. At the beginning of your months, so this is the beginning of the 7th month, right? But it says here that they were used across the board for the beginning of months. And then you shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your peace offerings. And they shall be a memorial on the Lord your God. So there we have those 4 things. So gathering together, moving the camp, the war, and particularly in getting God's help with the war. And then the 4th one is the celebrations, but particularly, if you like, religious celebrations. So these were the 4 things. And so it doesn't say which one of those is meant to be for the Feast of Trumpets. It doesn't say, this is the one for the Feast of Trumpets. This is just general trumpets. And it's up to us to try and work out, do we apply some of them? Do we apply all of them? I guess baseline level, you could say, oh well, the Feast of Trumpets is about announcing big things, because these are big things. So you're going to move the camp, want everyone to come together, we've got a big celebration, we've got a big war to fight. So you say, well, if we're trying to derive and work it out from scratch, say, oh okay, maybe it's a day about announcing big things. Maybe that's all right. Maybe that's not such a bad way to think either. But there's another one that we missed. So this is number 5, and that's in 1 Kings. 1 Kings 1. And you can tell what this point's going to be by the name of the book that we're going to. If I can find it. 1 Kings 1 and what verse? 39. So now this is after David, next king. Then Zadok, the priest, took the horn of oil from the tabernacle and he anointed Solomon. So now this is Solomon becoming king. And they blew the horn. And all the people said, "Long live King Solomon." So here we're starting to have another way in which loud announcements are made. And the people went up after him, and the people played flutes, rejoiced with great joy, so the earth seemed to split with their sound. So if you're an academic trying to categorize things, I'll say, oh, this might fall under the celebration thing. But I think it's a separate point. Announcing the king. Big, loud noise. It was so loud, the earth seemed to split with the sound. And of course, Adonijah, when he was the one who wanted to be king, he could hear what was going on. So it was a massive, loud announcement. So there we go. We got those five things. Gathering together, moving camp, going to war, having a celebration, particularly a feast celebration, and announcing the king. But it doesn't say which one of those the Feast of Trumpets is about. So we don't want to jump to conclusions, because you could just grab this one. Ah, Feast of Trumpets is about the king. It doesn't say that yet. Certainly, it makes sense that it's a day about announcing something big. That much, I think, is quite reasonable from what we've read to conclude that. But I still think it's a bit of a mystery here. If we're honest, let me read it. It's not, if the kids read it to the kids, it's not immediately obvious this is exactly what it means. I think there's a mystery here. But I think that's okay. I think there is meant to be a bit of a mystery here. And let me develop that a bit longer. This is just a prolonged introduction and we try and re-derive it. And here's a little hint. In Psalm 89:15, there's a real cryptic saying that I ran across that sort of adds to the mystery. Psalm 89:15. This is one verse. It says here, "Blessed are the people who know the joyful sound." So that joyful sound, you're bumped into that scripture if you do the word search. You know how you do on your computer? Right click, bang, get all the words, all the scriptures that give you the same phrase in trumpets, as the Feast of Trumpets. You end up with this scripture. But isn't it a bit cryptic? So there's a special blessing on those who understand or know that loud noise. Maybe it's a literary license, but maybe we could read this. Blessed are those that understand what those trumpets are about. It's the same word. So it's a blessing if you understand it. But it hasn't told us exactly what it is yet. And so as I was reading these scriptures, oh man, there is a mystery here. There is a bit of a mystery going on. And there's little sayings like this. Hey, work it out. There's a bit of something hidden here. So for the kids, what's the story? The Enid Blyton ones that we read to the kids, I've forgotten the name of them now. And they start off, the kids are in the school holidays, they're bored to tears, they're just looking for a good mystery. And then they finally, they get one. Well, they got one here. I think we've got a good mystery here. The mystery of the blowing trumpets. What is it all about? That's the question. So let's read a little bit more and try and crack the mystery. And then we're going to discuss two aspects of the mystery. And so where should we go? Well, I thought we should go, seeing it's a day of making a loud noise, we should go to the two loudest books of the Bible. So what do you reckon the two loudest books of the Bible are? There might be other ones. You might think of one I didn't thought of. But I reckon these are the two loudest books of the Bible. So my guess, and I'll go there first, Revelation's a loud book. I'll prove that to you in a second. And then I reckon Psalms is a loud book because it's all about people yelling and singing and making a loud noise. So in the scriptures we've got, they're nearly all, there's a handful from the New Testament there, about three, but they're nearly all Revelation and Psalms. So I kind of did that on purpose to try and, otherwise, just gets out of control doing these things. So try and limit it. Don't worry, I've still got plenty. To Revelation and Psalms, because I reckon these are loud books. So let's go to Revelation, and I'll show to you that it's a loud book, and then as we're going to it, we'll try and work out what the mystery is, the mystery of this special blowing of trumpets. Because we've got rough things so far, but it hasn't been given, I don't think, specifically, what's going on. You have to work it out a bit. So let's go to Revelation 1 first, and 10:15. I've just got a few scriptures just to remind you. This is a really loud book. Revelation 1, verse 10. It says, "I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice, as of a trumpet." So straight up at the start of the book, it says, this book's loud. There's a lot of yelling going on. There's a lot of big volume. So that's why I'm talking loud on purpose. Loud day. It's the sound of a trumpet And then a voice talks. It says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega. What you see, write in a book. And then I turned and I saw the voice that spoke with me. And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And so then he explains it a bit further, and it goes down, and he says, in the midst of those, there was one just like the Son of Man. He had a garment down to his feet and his chest with a golden band. His hair and his hair were like wool, white as snow. His feet were like fine brass, refined in a furnace. And his voice was like the sound of many waters, more noise. When he spoke, it was like the rushing of a waterfall. It's loud stuff. 4 verse 1. So the start of chapter 4. After these things I looked and I beheld, a door was opened in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet. So again, he has a loud noise that says, hey, come up here and I'll show you the things which must take place after this. So it might not be the same mystery, but it's looking like here that John is getting told a few secrets. And they're being yelled at him. Voice like a trumpet, come up here, I'm going to show you some stuff that's going to happen. I'm going to show you some secrets. I'm going to show you some things that are happening in the future that people don't know yet. And so it kind of builds as you read through the book. I know there's a lot of details in between, so it's nice to sort of skip some of these points. So let's go down to start of chapter 5. That's just right here. And I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne. So now he's showing what's a bit of a vision. It's someone on the throne. Well, this is God on the throne. And he has a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. So there's this little book rolled up. The books back then were rolled up. And this is sealed. I think that inside this book is the answer to the mystery. And so we've got this mystery, but I think it's inside this. Maybe you could say, oh, it didn't. But as we read, I think it is. So we've got this scroll that's all sealed. And in it is the answer to the big mystery, I think. And then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice. Again, more volume. Angels yelling. Who is worthy to open the scroll and loose its seal? Saying, look, there's a book here. It's all in there. The stuff we want to know is in there. But who's going to open it? Who's going to read it? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or look at it. So no one could. And so I wept much because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll to look at it. Now, my kids get a bit upset if I say time to bed before they finish the book. But they don't usually get that upset. They don't cry that much. But this guy, John, he's extremely upset. Okay, he's in a vision, so his emotions are being really played with. But he is really upset that as things were evolving, no one could open it. So it was like there was something he was burning to find out that was in those. Because it's written down stuff, right? We know that as it gets opened, things start happening, it gets enacted. But I think there are the elements of something mysterious going on here. I think it's okay. It's not too much literary license to think like this, I think. So you got this. And he's desperate to find out. What's in it? Open it. I want someone to open it. I want to know what's going on. He's itching to know the mystery. You show me this scroll, but what's in it? It looks flashy. I want to know what's in it. And you know how this then rolls out. And we see that in 6.1. And now when I saw the Lamb open one of the seals. Okay, so it's Christ. Christ gets to open the secret and reveal the mystery of what's inside the scroll. Now, we haven't proven at all yet that it's the same mystery of what the trumpet's mystery is. So we've got two mysteries going on parallel almost here. But they do come together, as you know. Well, I think they come together. So he hears this. As he opens the seal, what happens? He hears another voice like thunder. So the two mysteries are sort of coming together because we've got all the volume and the yelling with this other mystery of the scroll. And it says, come and see. I'm like, okay, come and have a look. I'm opening it. Christ is opening it. Come and have a look, John. I'm going to show you what's inside the mystery. And so 8 verse 6. You have a bit more piece of the puzzle. And, so just high-level view revelation. That scroll had seven seals. You know this, but just revision. Seven seals in that scroll. So you could peel off a bit And then you couldn't keep opening it because it was stuck with some more wax. And so you had to take that seal and you get to the next bit. So it was like this roll of a book was continued stuck together. It's like the pages of your Bible with sort of clips on it. You'd open the first bit, but then something has to happen before you get to the next one. So there was those seven seals. But when you get to the seventh one, there's the seven other things. And that's what we got here. Verse 6 of chapter 8. So the seven angels had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. That's when you get to the seventh seal. So finally you're opening the book. You're not doing it, but the scroll gets opened. You get to the seventh one and you find there's seven more things. Now it's seven angels with seven trumpets. So the volume ramps up. And just, we won't get there, but then just for the sake of the story, when you get to the seventh angel, then there's another seven plagues that come after that. So you think you're there, but there's a little bit more. Then after the seven plagues, then you're done. But let's go back now. We're just realizing that the volume increases. Now we've got seven angels with seven trumpets. And so in understanding the mystery of this scroll, we're getting confronted with these massive volume, and now we've got angels with trumpets. So the two mysteries are coming together as we read. It's loud. It's big. It's big stuff. Chapter 10. Chapter 10 and verse 5 to 7. And then the angel whom I saw... A lot of noise happened in between, but we just skipped over it. The angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his hand up to heaven. And he swore by him. So he's sort of saying, very strong. He's saying, this is definitely going to happen, what I'm saying. He swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and the things that are in it, the earth and the seas that are in it, and the sea and all the things in it, that there should be delay no longer. Saying, okay, no more delay. But in the days of the sounding of the seventh angel, so that's the seventh of all those angels, in the days of the sounding of the seventh angel, when he's about to sound, the mystery of God will be finished, as he declared to his servants the prophets. So as he's reading it now, John and the angel is actually admitting it. There is a mystery here. There is something mysterious. And now they're being upfront with it. We've had to work it out that it was a bit mysterious. And now it's upfront. You finally get to the seventh angel here after the seventh seals. And it says, okay, this mystery, the answer to the mystery, it's finally, no more delay, time to look at the answer to the mystery. And it comes with like the seventh angel, like the ultimate angel of noise, the ultimate one with the trumpet. It's only him that then leads into the answering of the mystery. So the two mysteries have converged. The mystery of history, if you like, that all the prophets have had these things said to them, and the mystery of this holy day, which just sort of seemed to stop. They're the same mystery, I think. And this is what it's saying to us here anyway. We're going to find the answer now. When the seventh one sounds. So when does it sound? It sounds over in 11 verse 15. It's a big mystery. It's a big thing. It's not just the. It's just not what does a certain feast day celebrate. It's about what is history waiting for to find out. And in verse 15, we start to read it. The seventh angel sounded. So again, loud noise, trumpet, thumping noise that you couldn't imagine. And then there's loud voices in heaven to go with the trumpet. There's loud voices. So it is very loud, all this. Saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord. So, what are the loud voices saying? As the mystery gets revealed, the answer in part is that there's a new king. That the kingdoms of the world are no longer going their own way. They're going to become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And he shall reign forever and ever. So as the mystery is getting revealed, it's about a king. And that was one of the elements that we read in Numbers. Well, actually, that came later in Kings. But that was one of the elements that we were wondering about with the trumpet noise, announcing a king. So one of the elements is tallying up with this answer to the mystery. So let's keep reading on. What else happens? So then there's 24 elders who've been watching all this, and we'll come back to them later if I don't run out of time. And the 24 elders who sat before God on their thrones, they fell on their faces. So they're pretty impressed by all this and all this loud noise. And they worship God. And they say this, we give you thanks, O Lord God Almighty, the one who is, who was, and is to come. So this is the mystery. That he is now, that he was, he has been, and he's going to come. This is the big element of the understanding the mystery, I think. because you have taken your great power and reigned. So, yep, he's coming to be king. Then verse 18 is some more information, which we have to touch on a bit later. The nations were angry. Your wrath has come. So the nations are in foul attitude. They're stroppy. They're angry. But the wrath of God has come. It's the time of the dead that they're going to be judged. And that you should reward your servants, the prophets, and those who fear your name, small and great, and you should destroy those who destroy the earth. So this angel has now said these things, or the 24 elders are saying these things, as the mystery gets unraveled. And so what is the answer to the mystery? The first part we're reading here is that it's got to be a new king. The kingdoms are going to become God. It says it is war here. It says that he's going to destroy those who destroy the earth. So there is war. And that's another thing that we read about the trumpets signifying. So trumpets and war, yep, the elements are coming together. But then it says here also that there's going to be a reward for your servants, the prophets. So those that have kind of been waiting, they hadn't been given a reward. And I think there we're starting to get the elements of celebration. Not 100% proof that it links up, but surely we could consider that element of trumpets being trumpeted, loud noise, a celebration that the servants, the prophets, the saints will receive the reward that's been promised to them. So I think it is coming together, and this is totally consistent, I think, with what we've always understood. But I think there is this mystery that becomes unravelled as you read through the scriptures, and it's a very precious one. Like it said in Psalm 89, it's blessed those that understand the joyful noise and what it means. Now, there was one I missed out. Because it said the trumpets were used, the first thing was to gather Israel together. So just to nail it, let's go to Matthew 24 and verse 29. Matthew 24 and verse 29. Just a little one there. Immediately after the tribulation of those days. So this is Christ, in the middle of Christ, talking about the future. There's going to be trouble. Because immediately after those days, the sun's going to be darkened, the moon won't give its light, stars will fall from heaven, powers will be shaken. Okay, big stuff's happening again. Big stuff. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and glory. So we've got some coinciding of events here. We just read about kingdom becoming Christ. That's a promise of the future. Now we're reading that Christ is talking about Son of Man coming. Then it says here, and he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. So we've got now some more noise. We've got angels and we've got trumpets making loud noise again. But what are they going to do? They will gather together the elect from the four winds from one end of heaven to the other. So it's exactly what we read. Trumpets were used very early on. It's to gather Israel together. And here it's an angel blowing the trumpet and it's gathering all of those of God's people from one end of heaven to the other. So it's no stretch. It's no stretch at all when we look into the Feast of Trumpets and we see all these big things associated with it. It takes a while to get there from reading the scriptures as the mystery becomes unravelled. But the link is extraordinarily strong, that this is definitely a day of announcement of big stuff. And the big stuff includes all of these great things that we think about. But it's busy, right? It's busy. That what we read there in Revelation, there's huge things. There's rewarding of the saints. There's establishing a new king. There's the war. So these are some of the things that we have to come to grips with, because it is a day to rejoice. It's not a day to be bashing ourselves, hey, this, or mourning, because they were told not to mourn. It's a day to be on the front foot. And so when we read this and we read about the promise of the reward to the saints, it's if you like, easy to be on the front foot. So we should read some of those in a second. That's one facet. I said we've got two facets. That's one facet. We'll read a few out. And very important for us to reflect on this promise of the reward and all those that are in the grave waiting for it. They're still waiting, tapping the foot, come on. I mean, they don't know they're doing it, but you get that impression when you read sometimes. They're waiting in the grave. Come on, I'm ready for it. But then there's this other one about he's going to destroy those who destroyed the earth. There's going to be a war at the same time. And it is part of a celebration. And this is confronting. And so I'm going to read some scriptures about that as well. So they're the two facets. Our great reward, but also there is a time of trouble, but that is part of the celebration. So let's get on with it. So let's go for the first bit, only got a couple. Let's go now to 1 Corinthians 15, and I can lower my voice a bit, because, no I can't, because there's a trumpet here as well. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 50. So Paul understood that there was a great mystery that he had cracked, or that he was given the keys to cracking as well. And he talks about it here in this resurrection chapter. Well, that's it. It's the resurrection. It's a massive key to the mystery of history. Now, this I say, brethren, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. So Christ is going to come back. There's going to be this new kingdom, but flesh and blood can't be part of it. So we've got a problem here on our hands. Well, here's the answer to the problem, is I'll tell you a mystery. He's saying there's a mystery. I'll tell you a mystery. We're not going to all sleep. We shall be changed. You're not going to stay in the grave. You will be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. The clues are everywhere that this Feast of Trumpets, that the announcements of the next age and the big things to come are linked to the reward of the saints. And that requires they be resurrected. How can you just reward those that are alive at the time? He has to reward all of them. And so the answer to that mystery is going to raise them up. In a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, the last trumpet. It's almost as if Paul, I wonder sometimes whether Paul had a version of John's vision. The way he talks in a couple of places, especially this chapter, actually probably mainly this chapter, but a few other hints that you get from him, it's like he'd seen a similar vision or had a similar explanation. Because now he talks about the last trumpet. So it says, well, hang on, there's one before it. So he knew stuff, perhaps similar to John. Don't want to get carried away, but he says anyway, he calls it the last trumpet. And when we read Revelation, it makes total sense. That trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised incorruptible, and we shall all be changed. So this is a tremendous promise, a tremendous hope that we have, and something that is particularly more easy to appreciate when you're not well. Maybe that sometimes helps us when we're not well, when we know people are not well, helps really appreciate this amazing promise. Also, as you're confronted with yourself, like Paul says, you know, this body of death, then with that appreciation, you can appreciate this promise is something that you really, really desire. It's not our job today to reflect on those side, but on the positive side. It's an amazing promise. 1 Thessalonians 4, and I'm afraid I still can't lower the voice yet, because this is also given at full volume, 1 Thessalonians 4. Where are we going? Where's Thessalonians? A bit past Colossians. 1 Thessalonians, what did I say? 4 verse 13. I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep. He says, look, I don't want you to be ignorant. I want you to understand something, he's saying. I want you to understand in your head about those that have died. Don't sorrow like those who don't have the key to the mystery of history. Don't sorrow like those who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus Christ died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. I was saying, it's stupid to think that Christ died and came back to life if you don't also think he's going to raise up his people. Having half the story doesn't make sense. He's basically saying, if we understand this, if we believe that Christ did die and rise again, well, then we will believe that God will bring with him those who have dead. Sleep in Jesus, that's what it means. For this we say to you, by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. So, that's his nice word for dead. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven. What with? With a shout. And now I'm losing my voice. And the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God. So Paul saw something in when he was explained this, because Paul didn't just work it out, right? He didn't just click. He didn't read Revelation. So Paul was explained something, and when Christ explained it to Paul, he gave him the big noise as well. He gave him his trumpets and his announcements and his loud. So he had a loud presentation too when he got taught this stuff. And he's sharing it. He's saying, with the trumpet of God, the dead in Christ will rise first. We are alive and remain will be caught up together. Interesting when he says, we who are alive and remain, you always wonder whether he had some of his timing was a bit confused, perhaps. We? Well, it's us. Maybe he's talking generically of saints, but maybe Paul did think it was going to be a bit sooner. We who are alive and remain will be caught up together with him in the clouds, meet the Lord in the air, and you will always be with him. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. So part of today's celebration, it is meant to be encouraging. And it is meant to be something that we comfort ourselves with and each other with. But it does feel corny to sit down and say, oh, it's all right, Christ is coming back. Be honest, when we're sitting at lunch, I guarantee you none of you will say that to each other, probably. Yeah, maybe you would. And so we've got to get over that somehow and be open with it. And it is a point of encouragement. It can sound trivial. Oh, it's all right, Christ is coming back. And so it's not meant to be trivial, but it is meant to be the anchor and the core of how we get through life. It's the answer to the mystery. It's what gives the sense. Without that, it makes no sense. Like Paul says, I don't think I'm going to read it. It says if you're going to come to God, you have to believe he'll bless those, he'll reward those who serve him. Without that, it makes no sense. So it's good to remind each other of the things that give life sense. Because without this mystery, without unlocking that scroll and seeing what's coming, if that scroll stays closed, it doesn't make sense. Let's be honest, it doesn't. And so this is part of the reason why Christianity doesn't get much following. Okay, there's lots of reasons. One, it's because they behave in a most horrendous way. But another part is, it's missing. It doesn't make sense. You put it on the scales, it doesn't balance. It doesn't hold. So this is a very special thing we've been given. We've been given the sense of it. Okay, we don't understand. It's still not 100% there. But we've been given to see inside it so that it does make an incredible sense. And we should remind each other of it. And it is true, and there's lots of scriptures, but I'll only read one. There's lots of scriptures that do acknowledge that things have been going on a long time and nothing's happened yet. It looks like Paul was waiting for it. But now we're 2,000 years later, still nothing's happened. And there are quite a lot of scriptures that deal with this. And it's not just us that think that. People have thought that throughout history. God's people have said, where are you? What's going on? So, in one sense, we're in good company. It's not just us that have felt that. Now, others will use that and say, therefore, it's not true. They have no basis for that, because all of those things that have happened in Israel, when they said this is going to happen, God gave it, it happened. But they had to wait for it. And so in Hebrews, there's a little reminder of that. In Hebrews 10, that's all I was going to read, 35, but there was a whole lot I had in my notes we could have read. But let's 10:35. It says, therefore, don't cast away your confidence, which has great reward. So you have a confidence in the mystery of what this day means. Don't throw it away. Children, don't throw away these things you heard from your mum and dad, that you're hearing from me now, that you read in the Bible. Don't throw these things away, because it looks like Christ hasn't come. That's why it's been foolish of people to say Christ is coming next year. Christ is coming in 16 months. That's foolish on so many grounds, but on one of them is because it gives cause for people to throw away their confidence, because you create something. So you've got to be very careful with what we say, especially to the young ones, and bed it in truth. I know it's not a problem that we have, but it's a problem that other people have had over history, for sure. Anyway, so don't cast away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance. This was written 2,000 years ago. Maybe Paul, even though he was thinking maybe it's come soon, he also knew that you've got to hang in there. So that was on the early version of my notes, but it sort of dropped off now. We've got to hang in there. We've got to hang in. It looks like it's not coming. In St. Peter it says it looks like things continue as they always have been. And so you have the theories of evolution and all that, which may have some interesting things in them, but they just say it just keeps rolling on like it always has. But it doesn't. That's the mystery. It doesn't just keep rolling on. Okay, for you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while he who is coming will come, and he will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, But if anyone draws back, my soul doesn't have pleasure in him. So he says, look, he is coming and he will not tarry. You know, he won't keep holding off. He will come. An interesting thing, we read it a little while ago when it talked about that seventh angel. It said, there's no more delay. They're acknowledging there is a delay. It is the acknowledgement that we've been waiting for this, that history has been waiting, that it is taking time. Okay, it's going on. This is what we're reading here. It was actually quoted from, Habakkuk. It's a quote from Habakkuk. I should double check for you. Let me just read down, but I'm pretty sure it is. Habakkuk. It's from Habakkuk. So it was written probably 600 or so years before this. And it was saying he won't tarry. He won't. He'll come. And they still waited 600. And now it's still 2000. So it's acknowledged within the scriptures that give the promises that it's going to take time for them to be enacted. That's part of the mystery. That's part of the seals. Each one opens and it stops. Another one has to be broken. So don't let that shake us, that there's all these promises that haven't happened yet. People who say, oh, look, it hasn't happened, there's all these promises, there's no basis for that at all. That's wrong thinking. All right, so this promise will come, and it's sure as eggs are eggs. I don't know if that's the saying. But now we've got to deal with the other facet, which is the confronting one, because the two sides to the coin. He comes to give his reward to the saints, but he also comes to give trouble to those that have been messing up badly. And that is part of the celebration. The celebration, it would not make sense if the celebration was only one-sided, I'm afraid. And I know myself, I've not been comfortable with that. But there is the celebration of what this pictures. It's double-sided. There's two facets. The promise that is given to those who have the reward of the saints, and there's those that have been abusing and destroying other people, abusing and blaspheming God, also get a consequence, a big consequence, for a big reason, for what they've been doing. That's part of that we have to face, and it's not always easy to deal with this. And just to acknowledge that this is a serious matter, let's go back to Revelation 8, something I skipped over before as we're reading. Revelation 8. I'm not saying that we laugh at this, but it is something that celebration is not about laughing. Celebration is about realizing this is something precious and needful and valuable and good. But there is a serious side, and that's what it says here. When he opened the seventh seal, so that was the seventh seal contained those seven trumpets, right? The first thing were the seven seals, then the seven trumpets. So when he opens the seventh seal, he's about to see the seven trumpets. And what happens? There's silence in heaven for half an hour. So with all this noise that we've been talking about, all these announcements and trumpets, suddenly, in the middle of this loud book, heaven just shuts up. And so they've opened, click, the scroll's open, and they've looked. I think this is the way to look at it. They've looked. Oh, wow. And everyone's just been quiet. It's big stuff. And it's serious. And there is... part of this, there's blood to be spilled. But I've got some things to read to help us deal with that in a second. So let's read on. There's a silence. And then after the silence, he sees the seven angels who stand before God were given the seven trumpets. So before this big announcement of these big events, there's just sort of taking stock of what's about to happen. Then another angel, having a golden censer, he came and he stood at the altar. So now we've got to just go with this vision. The angel has got this golden container of some sort, and he comes and stands in front of an altar. So in his vision, there's a throne room and there's an altar there. And he was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of the saints. So somehow I get the feeling that in this container, there's prayers. It's a container of all the prayers that have been said by the saints over history. In this container, there's incense, so that's sort of a way of giving it to God, I guess. And he's going to offer it with the prayers of the saints before the throne. So it's like, here, we're bringing this out, and we're We're dealing with what's in this container. We're going to deal with the prayers of the saints that have been said throughout history. It's time to deal with them. And that smoke of the incense, they ascend before God. So it comes up to God, this big container of containing what God's people have been praying over history. And then the angel took the censer. So he takes it then, and he fills it with fire. So the altar's there, and he takes the fire off it, so the coals and the things that are hot, and he takes it and puts it back into the bowl and takes the bowl back down. It says here, the angel took the censer, filled it with fire, and then he threw it to the earth. So the prayers of all the saints come back up, and God says, yep, okay, this is what they've been saying. This is what's been happening throughout history. Time to do something about it. Put it in the bowl, throw it back on earth. So then it gets thrown back down. And what is there? The noise, thunder, lightning, and earthquake. And then the seven angels with the seven trumpets prepare themselves to sound. So this trouble that comes with these seven trumpets comes from, in the way we've introduced it here, from the prayers of the saints. So it is a consequence of what the saints have been praying. And we know what they've been praying throughout history, in part, because we can read about it. And you can read a lot about it in that other loud book, Psalms. And so the book of Psalms, you know, has a lot to say about the trouble that the wicked need to be confronted with. And I think Psalms gives us a hint of a good amount of the contents of that bowl. And because Psalms are prayers, they're not just songs, they're loud, but they're loud prayers. They're prayers that David prayed, but that then David wrote and gave to everyone, because they tell us how, in part, we should think. So you can say, and it's easy to do this, David, man of blood, couldn't build the temple of God, therefore those Psalms of yours, they're full of blood, I can ignore that. Now, I'm not trying to argue for bloodthirstiness at all, but I think that's a bit of a easy out that we shouldn't take. I'm not trying to say David wasn't a man of blood, but there are actually two sides to the reason why he didn't build the temple. There's the side that says he was a bloodthirsty man. Then there's also the version that Solomon gives, and that he was actually a bit busy dealing with the enemies of Israel. He's a bit too busy to actually have time to stop from war to build the temple. So there are two ways. I've repeated myself, just one angle. You're just too bloody. And it's true, there were times when he got carried away. He was told to get, 100 foreskins? He got 200. I'm not trying to say that, but there are two sides to that temple story, just to acknowledge the truth. It's like in a media, you read one newspaper, you read The Age, you get one version, and it's not that extreme, but Solomon was nicer to his dad. Basically, dad was a bit busy with all the wars, now we have peace. Thanks, dad, now I can build his temple that he wanted to build. Okay, let's not get too carried away with that, but back to Psalms, and let's try and deal with some of this. don't worry, we'll manage it. We'll still have lunch sometime. So let's start right at the start of Psalms, and because it gets straight into it. It acknowledges these two facets straight away in Psalms 1. So I'm going to read you Psalms 1 to start with, and then we'll knock over a few others in a minute. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. So that's saying there's a reward. I think that's focusing on what we've already said. There's a reward for the saints. It says, blessed is the man. So in other words, it's going to come back to you good for you who strive not to go in the way of sinners, not to be scornful, but to delight in God's way. You will be rewarded. So start of Psalms, it's giving us that same message that we've already talked a bit about. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that brings forth its fruit in season, whose leaf is also not going to wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. If you go back to that little saying that we started off with in Revelation 11, these two psalms just expand on it. You can piece them up almost exactly. They talk about the reward. He's talking about the reward here. It's almost the same. Same content, just is expanded here. And that's what psalms do. They sort of a bit flowery, aren't they? But then it says in verse 4, the ungodly are not like this, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore, the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. So there's going to be trouble. There's going to be judgment, and the chaff is going to drive them away. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Double barrel. He will reward the righteous, and there is the way of the ungodly is going to stop. That's a nicer, sanitized way of saying it. But as we read on, it's not so sanitary. Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? So now we have angry nations. We read that in Revelation 11 when we read that little passage. It says the nations are angry. Here it says the same in Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. So what we're talking about here, it seems, just straight up, is a whole lot of angry countries forming a confederate against God and his guy. And so this is straight out of Revelation, if you like, but it was just written about 1,000 years before it. And so it's like, it doesn't make sense. These nations are enraged against the very one who saved them. And this is a part of an insight in why there is this need for the wrath of God that will come when this day gets unraveled. You've got this madness of nations against God and his Son, who did so much for mankind and has done so much and will do so much, and yet they're mad, they're angry without a reason against him. How do you deal with that? Well, this is how it's been dealt with. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. Now, people who are a bit on the vengeful side like making hay with that, but what's that is saying is that there will be the victory. That God will get the victory. The Lord will hold them in derision, and he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. So he will deal with it in the way they're asking to be dealt with. So you have a little kid that comes in kicking and fighting and is asking to be dealt with in a certain way. He's not asking to be sat down and reasoned with. Even Caleb, when he comes in, he starts ripping your nostrils out and you're taking bits out. He's sort of asking to be dealt with in a rough way. He's not asking, oh, Caleb, can you please stop doing it, as he pulls and gouges my eye. And so he's kind of setting a tone for, he expects me to say, no, Caleb. He's like setting the tone for how we're dealing with each other as he's gouging my eye out. Now, I know you don't want to get too carried away. I don't sit there and beat him, by the way. But he's setting a tone. He's setting a tone to how to deal with each other. And there's a tone set here when you've got the nations saying, I want to stick it to you, Christ and God. I want to kill you. They set the tone to how they're going to deal with. This is one facet. We've got a whole lot of facets here. We'll get through maybe half of them that will help us to understand that we can celebrate part of this. This needs to be rightened. You can't have nations that are just mad and want to somehow find a way through watching too many supernatural movies that they can kill Christ and his Son. And then God says, well, yet I've set my king. So my king's going to deal with it. And the king's in capital letters here. I think that's right because it's Christ. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I've begotten you. As ask of me and I will give you. So this is Christ. So Father and Christ having a chat. You're my son, you're king. Ask me and I will give you the nations for your inheritance, the end of the earth for a possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and you'll dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. It's hard to read that. But they set the tone. They were trying to bash him in pieces. They were trying to destroy him. And God's saying, you'll be king and you can deal with it and you can show and you should show that wrathful response to the tone that they set. That's the right response. They need to be given that response. And now in this is a little bit of a warning. And this is part of God as well. He's not doing it right now. He's not doing it now, but his people now that are that angry towards God. You can hear them. They spit venom. Dawkins does it. There's a lot of others you'll hear. They spit. My university is full of them. Give them half a chance, the venom which they have towards God and their Creator. and he's saying, but they're alive now. He's continuing. He slept well last night, I suspect. He'll sleep well tonight. And God's written down this to give him a chance. So you can focus on, oh, how just intolerant. I don't want a God who's like this. That's what people say. I don't want a God like this. Well, I do want a God who's like this. Because he's telling them it's going to happen to give him a chance to avoid it. How good's that? Now, therefore, be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest you be angry and you perish in the way. When his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are those who put their trust in him. So he's saying his wrath is only going to be kindled but a little in the end anyway. But here's a chance to avoid it. So this is the positive side of it. So in a sense, they've got the boy gouging my eyes, but he is explaining to him, saying, oh, well, the last boy that did that, or the next boy that does that is going to get in trouble. He is actually talking. Does that make sense what I'm saying? He's saying there's going to be wrath ahead, but let's look at the reality. It's not there now. And so there's a lot of people that die in their beds, deserving of it, despite the fact that they've abused God every breathing moment of their life. So he's going to be harsh. And there is silence in heaven. But it's going to be then. It's not every day, continually even. This is an amazing insight, and maybe it'll come out again as we read. I want to give you some other facets to help deal with it. This is the big one. This anger and fight, try and kill and tear down Christ. They've set the tone for it. He's going to respond with the same tone. But he's not doing it all the time. There will be a time, though, when he does respond with it and say, look, I am angry. And you can read that in Psalm 7. Let's read that in Psalm 7. one to 11. So I'm going to... look, it's probably good for me to go through the Psalms and just grab little bits here and there. But that's like going to an art gallery, to be honest, and taking out the Mona Lisa ear and saying, oh, look at that, that's a nice ear, and going over to a Gauguin and taking out that nice pretty girl and looking at that. It's not doing a good thing for the artist, really. So I'm going to read the psalm from the start up to the bit I want to read you, because I feel like I'm being a bit rude. David spent ages, he agonized over these, I bet you. But it's hard to read them, isn't it? Because you're sort of, on. But yet, each one of these is like a painting that the guy agonized over. I mean, he prayed, but he wasn't the poet just like that. I mean, he prayed it. But then he composed it here. Well, this is what I was praying last night. I should share this. And then, I don't know, but I guess it's like that. It makes sense to me that that's how it worked. Because you haven't got the rambles. You know your prayers, right? If you wrote them down, it'd be longer than Psalms. And so, anyway, you got the point. I'm going to read the start of this and then stop at the point I really want to make. But it'll help us get to the spirit of it as well, because that's what we've got to get to. We've got to get to this day and its spirit and what it means, both facets. O Lord my God, in you I put my trust. Save me from all those who persecute me and deliver me, lest they tear me like a lion, rending me in pieces while there is none to deliver. Here's one of the prayers that goes in the bowl. And you've had that. You've had injustice towards you. We're blessed with fair. Imagine those people on that mountain in Iraq. I don't know. I mean, you could probably go to their tradition and say, oh, look, they're worshipping idols and whatever. But the bottom line was, they called themselves Christian and they got driven to the extremities of their country and they were going to get murdered for it. And we haven't had to do that yet. So give it their credit that quite possibly they put some things in that bowl. And America, for all its trouble, okay, they maybe helped a few people out there by bombing a few of the guys chasing them up the hill. I'm not sitting there trying to justify it or whatever, but these are part of how understand why it is a celebration to have some justice administered in a big way, with the trumpets and with the loud noise, because of that's terrible. Those, I mean, you saw the pictures. There were kids dressed like your kids and my kids. I didn't see many pictures, fortunately, but I did see enough to see kids that looked just like my kids walking up that mountain, not for a bushwalk, but to die, because they were being driven there, because they called themselves a follow Christ. So we've got to give some credit to that. And this is understanding this helps us understand the day, I think. Lest they tear me like, I can read that. O Lord my God, if I have done this. In other words, if I have been bad, he's saying. If I have deserved this trouble I'm getting, says David. Is it David? Yep, David. If David says, if if there is iniquity in my hands, if I have repaid evil to him who is at peace with me, if I have plundered the enemy without a cause, then the enemy pursue me and overtake me. Let him trample me. He says, well, all right, this trouble I'm getting, if I deserve it, I deserve it. But I don't, God. It's not just. So he's calling out because of the injustice against him. Arise, O Lord, in your anger. Okay, so now he's praying for it. He's praying for this day. Be angry, God, please. Lift yourself up because of the rage of my enemies. Remember, we read about his anger, the anger towards God. Now it's the anger towards one of God's. Lift yourself up because of the rage. Rise up for me to the judgment you have commanded. You said it, you're going to judge it. Do it, please. There is a time we need to echo this prayer. If it's not for us personally, it's on behalf of those on that mountain, or it's behalf of David who's in the grave waiting for the fullness of what he prayed for. So the congregation of the peoples shall surround you. So this is the people gathered around him, but for judgment. For their sakes, therefore, return on high. The Lord shall judge the peoples. So yes, you should be judged. Be saying, well, judge me according to my righteousness. Saying, look, let's please give me my reward, but also deal with the terrible, terrible things that have been happening according to my integrity. Oh, let the wickedness of the wicked come to an end. Okay, so the objective he's coming out here now is to bring it to an end. Not just give, that's what we need to have. We need to have, you did this, you've got to get this. Yeah, in part. There is a deserving in part. But he's saying there's an end to this. I want the wickedness to stop. So that can help us pray and rejoice on this day, because it is the beginning of the end of wickedness. This wrath is the beginning of the end of the wickedness. Okay, I'm up to my hour. I'm on borrowed time. But this is, I want to keep reading this. So he's praying to judge me. So give me my reward. Let the wicked come to an end, but establish the just. For the righteous God tests the hearts and mind. My defence is of God who saves the upright. God is a just judge. He's just. But then it says here, God is angry with the wicked every day. Isn't that interesting? He's angry every day, even though he's not acting every day. He is saving it up for this. He's actually going to focus it on that. The reward he's going to give to everybody deserving of it. The wrath to a certain degree, I'll be careful how I say this, to wrath to a certain degree is reserved for a special generation that is particularly deserving. And for the others, they will be raised and they will be judged. But I don't get the impression it's the same day of the Lord type judgment that we read with these seven trumpets. This is a very subtle point, that it's a very interesting one, but it's an insight. I think it's an insight into that amazing nature of God. So what was I saying again? That you follow God, respond to him, he'll reward you as an individual. You abuse God, he will raise you up and there will be judgment. But the particular violent, strong, trumpet, blood-letting response that we do get when you read those seven trumpets is reserved for that particular generation that is particularly deserving. It's interesting. And you can read that when it says Babylon down, all the deaths of the saints are up into you. But they didn't do them all. Okay, I'll leave that hanging for you to discuss or argue with me later or to think about. But I think that was a little, when I saw that, it's a little vision of something I think could be quite valuable. But God is angry every day. This point is that he's responding to this. So we're not angry every day, but there's evil going on everywhere. And part of desiring this day to come and celebrating this day is being attuned to that evil that is going on. It's important. Without that, then the day doesn't make... half of it makes sense. You give me what I deserve, but what are you being so angry on the others? If you haven't seen and been responding to the evil... Of course, if it's personal, it's easy, but it's been going on. It's difficult to celebrate this day fully, if that makes some sense. I'll come back to that in a second. I'm going to skip one over in a sec. Let's go to... Okay, I was going to read the one, but it takes a while to get this, so I won't read it. This is that Psalm of Asaph. I remember you giving a message on them, and I remember doing some reading on it as well. Asaph says, short version, he says, God, I looked at all those evil people and they're doing very nicely. It's really hot in here. Can we turn it down? I'm struggling to stay awake, can I bet you? So short version of Asaph is that he says, God, those wicked people are doing well. They're driving BMWs, they're driving the Mercedes, and they're dying in their beds quietly. They're murdering and they're killing, and they've got a great mafia, and their dad was in the mafia, and they have a lovely village in Italy, and they're doing fine. Why don't I join them? Why do I be all this prudish stuff? What benefit? This is what Asaph says. He acknowledges it. So kids, if you ever think that it looks pretty good out there, read Asaph. It's not. Don't think, oh, I've discovered it. Oh, mum and dad were wrong. It's good out there. Rubbish. That's happened 1,000 years ago and thousands of years before that. It's old as the hills. Lots of people have thought it. Oh, it's good out there. Oh, there's people not obeying God. They're doing all right, thanks. God's not punishing them. See, you said you're going to punish God and you're not. Asaph says that. And then do you know what he says? In the end of the psalm, he says, in my words, but I understand the Feast of Trumpets. But I saw they're on a slippery path. And there will be a wrath in times ahead. There will be a reconciling. There will get rebalanced. I saw that. Ah, that's to make a point, God. You're going to give the Feast of Trumpets. You're going to show the wrath. You'll make a point. And you'll demonstrate for all history that it doesn't. It's not sweet. Because you get raised up after you fall nice and quietly asleep in your bed after you've murdered all your life, and you do have to face some music. And so that's what Asaph, that was a short version, or maybe it wasn't so short. Let's go to 83, and we get Psalm 83. It's still Asaph, but it's the second one that I wanted to read a bit of. And I will skip a bit of this and just hope that Asaph doesn't mind. So he calls again for it. He calls again what for? For this facet of the Feast of Trumpets. Don't keep silent, O God. Don't hold your peace. So God's been quiet. People are getting away with murder. He's saying, please don't keep silent. Don't hold your peace. Don't be still. For behold, your enemies make a loud noise. Those who hate you have lifted up their head. They're powerful, those who hate you, God. They have taken crafty counsel against your people. Oh, we've read this before. It's the same thing. It happens throughout history. They consulted together. They have said, come, let us cut them off. Let's get rid of Israel, the nation. But now I want to skip down to the very important point. So if you've just sort of fallen asleep, listen to this bit at least. Oh my God, make them like whirling dust. So give them trouble. Like chaff before the wind. As fire burns the woods. Wow, that's big stuff. And as the flame sets the mountains on fire. There needs to be the strong response that they've been calling out for throughout history. They've been gouging the eyes of people throughout history. They've been asking for the response. It's really funny. I told Caleb off once for doing that gouging of my eye, and then I saw him do it to Brielle, and straight away he turned around and looked at me. Straight away. He just looked at me. He said, hey, don't do that. And it's like asking me. So mankind has been asking for the response throughout history. I mean, when they get a little village and man has to set up his own rules, very often he gets a few things right. Not everything, but a few things. And a little thing will be this idea. If you do that, then you shouldn't do that, and that you should get that back to you. That man has re-derived that lots of times. There's kind of a naturalness to it. And man's been begging for it, if you like. And now he's saying, Asaph is saying, it needs to happen. Pursue them with your tempest and frighten them with your storm. Fill their faces with shame. But now we get through to the other side. And Asaph is starting to... He's a pretty cool guy, this Asaph. He's starting to get beyond the other side. And he says here, why? That they may seek your name, O Lord. So there is a coming out. There is a coming through the other side of this. That they may seek your name, O Lord. Let them be confounded and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish. So, yep, it's got to be a big response. Then 18, that they may know that you, whose name alone is the Lord. That there's a reason to it. And that it does bring that. Well, we know this, but you can see it even in the middle of these big fire-breathing psalms. Some you can't see it. And that's all right too. It still exists. But this is a big part of another facet of of being part of celebrating this day. This is needful to bring about people saying, yep, you are God. It's a necessary part of history. And we should celebrate that it's going to happen. Psalm 97 and Psalm 103. Can I take... Psalm 97. Let's go there. We'll see if we can make it a bit briefer. I'm going to skip it. It starts off what we've already read. I'm going to do the Mona Lisa thing and take it out for lunchtime. But I want to get to the point that I wanted to... It's a little key. It's a little key for helping us celebrate today in these hard things that we're reading. And that is simply in verse 10. The 97 verse 10. The start's very, very, it's very precious. It's like a nice painting. But this is what I wanted to say. You who love the Lord, hate evil. You can't have one without the other. And so, what do you mean hate evil? I mean, you have a natural hate for evil. When you see someone, if you imagine your car's parked out there, Pope, you just imagine if you saw someone started kicking into your car. I mean, it wouldn't be difficult to hate that evil, right? Hey, I mean, I could feel it already. I look up my car, someone starts bashing it. Your child, if someone mistreats your child, it's quite easy to hate that evil, in a sense. So it is right to hate evil, but at the full level of the evil of blasphemy against God, of the hearts of man which continually is against their Creator, we should feel strongly against it. And with that, then we develop, well, through the Spirit, of course, because you can have a vengeful, wrong hatred of evil, but a right despising of everything that is against God, then help celebrate today. You can't celebrate the fullness of today without hating evil. And you can't love good without hating evil either. The whole thing, it is all joined together. That's the main reason for that one, so we need a quick version of that. Psalm 103 is not really necessary because I've already kind of made the point. Okay, so we've explored this facet a little bit, and there's lots of sides to this, and it is worth wrestling with because I think this is a wrestle. I've always found it a wrestle. But it's not just half of this day that we look forward to. It's what this pictures, this mystery and those scrolls. It's the celebration of the whole lot. It's all needful for bringing about something very proper, very right, very amazing. Now, interestingly, we're going to go back for a couple of points in the in this loud book of Revelation. Because as this gets unravelled, this scroll and what's happening, the angels are there watching and they say stuff as it's going along. But fortunately, they say short things and so it won't take us long. Not like Psalms, which says long things. In Revelation, the angels say little things. And those little things that they say give us a little bit of extra insight to help us, another facet to help us understand a bit of this idea, this part of the day. So first one I want to go to is Revelation 4, 8. So, and we can go to verse 10. The 24 elders, so these 24 elders are quite busy in Revelation. They're falling down all the time, praying and yelling and saying things, and because they're watching all this. And they sit down, they fall down before him who sits on the throne, and they worship him. And they throw their crowns even before the... So these elders are interesting characters. And you can build a whole lot of theory of who they are. They have crowns on their heads. And they throw it before the throne saying, "You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honour and power." And now it gives a little bit of a reason. It says, "Because you created all things, and by your will they exist." So that image of our children and our car is not. I didn't choose it just by random. It's because it's ours. And we feel that the violence done against our children or our car, we feel it. And so God feels it against his people and his man that he made in his own image. So right from when Cain killed Abel, that blood has been calling out from the ground. It's a bit of God that has been abused. And so this is another facet. It's my stuff. It's been wrecked and I'm responding. That was the short version of that one. Nearly there. And in chapter 16, verse 4. And then verse 5. And I heard the angel of the waters saying this, "You are righteous, O Lord." So in other words, what he's doing is entirely right. In this, these scrolls and these trumpets and these trouble that is coming. The one who is and who was and who is to be. Says that again. It says it lots of times. That's the mystery. Because you have judged these things. For they have shed the blood of the saints and the prophets. So there's trouble here. Because people have killed God's people. And you have given them blood to drink. For it is their just due. So there is a certain justice. Well, a certain justice. There is the epitome of justice. That was a very bad word to use. It's the epitome of justice. They spilt the blood, and in this case, the water's being turned to blood. There is the link between what the trouble and the action to help in the understanding. The only reason for that is to help understanding. Otherwise, why not just make it big and make the point made that you've got to get it? No, but it's matching. It is justice. It's perfectly designed and worked out. Difficult to see. But in this passage here, the third angel pours out his bowl on the rivers and they become blood. And then those watching it, the angel says loudly, "Well, you're righteous. They deserve that. That's what they did. And that's what happened back." That's the justice of this. So, verse 15. Sorry, chapter 15, verse 1. Let's just go straight to the song here. This is the song of Moses. So it's loud still. And it gives that extra insight that we can wrap up with. It says this. Actually, who's singing it? Oh, I'll read it. "Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvellous, seven angels having the seven last plagues." So now this is the seventh trumpet. "I saw something like a sea of glass, and those who have the victory over the beast, over his image and over the mark." So these are all the saints. "They are standing on the sea of glass, and they sing this." So who's singing this? Those that are raised up on this day. They're singing this. "Great and marvellous are your works." So they're singing all this. As it unfolds, if you like, or after it's unfolded, we've got to get with this sentiment. It says, "Great are your works, Lord Almighty. Just and true are your ways." This is not, "Oh, a bit harsh, God." This is just, this is true. "O King of saints, who shall not fear you?" Ah, interesting. This is saying, after this, people will fear you. That's a good outcome, right? So the saints as saying, all this that's unfolding is good because look, they'll fear you, O Lord, and they'll glorify your name. For you alone are holy, for all nations shall come and worship before you. So that's our sentiment. You've got to be part of celebrating what's going to happen. But again, you celebrate this because this is where it's going to bring. For all nations have come and your judgments have been manifested. Finally, God says, yes, loudly and clearly, I am angry at all of these injustices. I saw them all. I was angry every day. They are all wrong. And I'm showing this anger on this particularly deserving generation because they've been so vile and so ugly and so bad. I'm going to pour it out. They've killed so many. And it's actually going to stand for my wrath over history. And then all the others, when I raise them up, I'll deal with them. There will be justice. There will be judgment. But this is the particular day of the wrath that we do celebrate. So it's a day that announces the beginning of the biggest thing that the earth has seen. And so what it heralds actually makes sense of history. It makes the sense. It balances the scales. I was going to do that. I was even going to bring scales, but it's actually a pagan. it comes from the Greek gods and all that. That's not a good touch. But it's going to balance. But it is true that it's a balance. It's going to balance it out. It's skew-if. Now it's balanced. And then, how does the whole book end? And this is how we should end things. It says, in verse 20 of Revelation, it says, "And he who testifies to these things, surely I'm coming quickly." Doesn't feel quick, but in his terms, he's coming quickly and surely. Okay, so I'm done. At hour 15. Shall I just get down and talk over lunch? Or have questions if there's anything? Any issues that need questions or things that I skipped over or something. Disagree?
I agree that justice has to be done. The God we worship is a God of justice, so all the problems have to be sorted out. I think, though, in Psalms that you were going through, you were linking them to the same event. I actually think the opposite. I think that they were descriptive of previous events. I think there's a link between the book of Psalms and Genesis, and Exodus, and Leviticus. And I think where it was talking about violence, goes right back in Psalm 1 to the violence of Cain and Abel. I think where there was the violence of the men plotting against God goes right back to Nimrod. And I think that we have to be very careful not to necessarily assume that some of the violence that we see in Psalms is predictive. It can be descriptive of what has actually happened.
Hmm. But that in Revelation is probably predictive.
I agree.
And that in Psalms matches remarkably closely that in Revelation. So often.
It also matches very closely to Genesis, Exodus and Leviticus as you go through the chapters too.
I guess the part that we have to remember is that God has not... He's shown patches of his wrath. Sodom and Gomorrah, boom.
Oh, no problem.
And... And so, but many, 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 many overlooked. And so that's that importance, I think, of the future focus of what so many of the psalmists are calling out for. Because they're calling out for things. David and Asaph, they're calling, God, rescue me. God, punish them. And look, I'm not going to argue. I'm not against what you're saying. It's history is intertwined. So, yeah, Peter.
Thanks, Matthew. So that archive is some real gems to think about. I had to think of something that I've come across in the last several months, you know, and you understand it, but don't we need sometimes to pray for, I don't know if it's vengeance, but we need, you know, people to learn the hard lessons the hard way, unfortunately. It's not like you want to get in the neck, but I remember the minister, we all know, used to say how to pray for, you know, there was some catastrophe going on around the world, you pray for the outcome, like an intercession, you know, and I think, like the prayers of the saints, so it's exploring the kids. It's not a natural thing to want to pray for your kids to learn a couple of lessons a little bit the hard way so that they get it, you know, really. But all the almost have to do that.
Yeah, I think we have to share in those sentiments of the Psalms in our prayers, but also the fullness of it, the bits that we read that it says, but then you'll bring them round. And of course, what Habakkuk said, in wrath, remember mercy. So he prayed that. So he prayed for wrath. And then he said, God, this is terrible. This is all going. This is all falling apart. They need. What's going to happen? Then he says, in wrath, remember mercy. I think it's Habakkuk. So yeah, I agree with you, but you pray that this is this. Yeah.
And the other thing, like you said at the end, you should have brought the balances in, but it couldn't help but think of, you know, the writing on the wall. You know, you've been counted, you've been weighed up, all the time we live in. You know, it's easy to say the great tribulation in the future, but we are now at war. And it's going to have serious consequences. Mm. Like, we may be being manipulated a lot more than is obvious, but we are at war, and things are going to happen. But there's obviously in Jeremiah 19:11, Jerusalem is going to be destroyed to never, ever be rebuilt. Well, when that happens, that will be the biggest shock. Like, and you read about it in the Psalms, you read, you know, about the vessel will be broken, never to be repaired. Ever. I mean, that would be horrendous. We're going into a time people want more. They're, you know, it's manipulated around money and power.
Yeah, right, from the beginning, like you said, back to Cain and Abel.
And also, I guess it wasn't the subject, but the two trumpets, weren't they also the one trumpet blasted for the leaders called the first trumpet blast? The second one was for the congregation. Well, I think that has relevance too. I toyed with the idea we should do a version when the saints come marching in.
Yeah, gathering in. Yeah.